Welcome to Chapter 7. Chapter 7 is a chapter that discusses a fundamental clash of rights. The rights of a defendant or a participant in a trial, generally a criminal trial, to get a fair trial, and the rights of the press and the public to get information about the judicial process. We call it the fair trial, free press conflict, or a clash. And it's a clash between the First Amendment of the Constitution and the Fifth and Sixth Amendment amendments of the Constitution, which give defendants the right to get a fair, speedy, and impartial trial. This chapter has to do with access to government proceedings. As a very quick recap, of course, we have three branches of government. We have a judicial branch, an executive branch, and a legislative branch. And all three of these areas have meetings, and all three of them generate documents. This chapter is primarily about access to the judiciary. Okay, we'll talk a little bit about some of the other stuff in later chapters as well. The reason that this is an important chapter to understand, particularly if you're in journalism, is that the media acts as a surrogate for the public. A surrogate is a stand-in, a substitute. Okay, so we cannot all be at a media trial or at a trial. We may not be interested in what's happening in a criminal trial. For example, I just saw this morning that, you know, Lindsay Lohan is going to be going to 90 days worth of jail. By the time you guys hear this in fall and spring, that'll be old news. But not everybody can go to her courtroom and see. So the media stands in to let us see what's going on in her situation. Right? So the media serves as the public stand-in. And that's something that's been recognized by the courts as an important function of the media. However, there is no First Amendment right to gather information. I'll say that again. No First Amendment right to gather information. So there is no really special additional rights of the media, but certainly the role as a surrogate for the public in trials has been supported in the courts. Okay. The O.J. Simpson murder trial was a big deal. It was a big deal because it taught the public the difference between a civil trial, which only has to do with money, and a criminal trial, which has to do with jail time. And it also delineated some of the problems within this clash. The right of O.J. Simpson to receive a fair trial and the right of the public to be informed about what was going on in this very high-profile trial. Judge Ito had a really tough tap dance to do. Judge Ito had to be sure that O.J. got a fair trial, but he had to be sure that the media's, you know, ever-increasing hunger for information was also fed. And it was a media frenzy. There are some things Judge Ito did right, some things he did wrong. The media had kept us all very well informed about the tumultuous relationship between O.J. and his ex-wife, and Nicole Brown. And so we were given to understand particular things about the O.J. trial. It still is a very important topic to think about today, because a lot of the elements that were established in O.J., such as the type of justice a person gets, depending on, you know, a number of different factors, continue to be relevant. Okay? But judges now are much more wary of letting the media in the courtroom, of making sure that the media manages itself correctly, and of making sure that there is no bias against a criminal defendant. So the O.J. case is important because, again, it provided us a national framework on the problems that are inherent with providing media access to trials, which, you know, the public needs, and making sure that a defendant is ensured his or her Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights. So let's talk a little bit about access to the judiciary. Again, clash between First Amendment rights and primarily Sixth Amendment rights, a little bit of Fifth Amendment due process stuff also. Okay, there is a common law right to an open courthouse and open court records, and we've established this through a number of different cases, some of which we'll talk about, starting in about the 1970s. Now, there are three elements that we're going to talk about inside this chapter, three ways that judges try to control the way in which the media participates in the court. First of all is a gag order. A gag order is a prior restraint. There's no pretty way to put it. Preventing the media from reporting on the case. We're going to find out that, generally speaking, those are unconstitutional. Second, judges will sometimes close the courtroom, and we'll talk about times when that might be acceptable. And finally, judges can and are willing to forbid cameras, and that might even be extended now to social media in the courtroom. And we'll talk a little bit about that as well. We'll start out with gag order law. But first, we're going to talk about some legal terminology. Pretrial or prejudicial publicity. Prejudicial publicity means publicity that would prejudice the jury pool against a particular defendant and make it difficult or impossible for a defendant to get a fair trial. For example, it would have been very difficult for Timothy McVeigh to get a fair trial in Oklahoma City. The ramifications of his alleged act were simply too high. Everybody had an opinion about him, and just about everybody's opinion was bad. So prejudicial publicity is publicity that makes it difficult or impossible for a defendant to get a fair trial because everybody who might be in the jury pool is biased against the person. A prior restraint is a gag order. Again, it's a general term when a judge wants to prevent the media from talking about this. 9.5 out of 10 times, they're going to be unconstitutional. And a gag order is a form of prior restraint particularly developed to apply to these situations. Okay, to stop, to gag the media from reporting on the process of a political or of a criminal trial. Generally speaking, as we're going to see, they're not okay. Now, here's some legal terminology that has specifically to do with the ways in which courtroom processes are run. Change of venue. A change of venue is a request to move the trial from one location to another. For example, in the Oklahoma City trial, there was no way Timothy McVeigh and his, you know, co-conspirators were going to be able to get a fair trial in Oklahoma City, so they moved the trial to Denver. That's a change of venue. They moved the Scott Peterson case as well from his hometown, which I believe, I always forget these, I think it's Fresno, and they moved it to Redwood City or Bakersfield, I forget. In any event, they moved his venue also because in his town there would have been a very tough time impaneling a jury that, you know, could be unbiased because of the high profileness of the case. So that's what a change of venue is. A continuance. A continuance is a delay, ostensibly to let the publicity die down. You know, old news gets replaced by new news, and the high profileness of a case tends to die down. So sometimes courts will grant a 2-week or a 1-month continuance to allow any pretrial or prejudicial publicity to die down. Few more legal terms. Voir dire, as we talked about in Chapter 1, is jury selection, French for to see, to speak. As we're going to see, there are some cases that permitted that to be open to the public. In fact, even as high up as now the Supreme Court. Sequestration is when you isolate or separate the jury members from the public and from media outlets so that they continue to keep an unbiased eye on the trial. Okay, tends to be expensive. It's not used in all. In most cases, it's got to be a pretty high-profile case. But sequestration has been successful in making sure that continuing publicity doesn't hit a sitting jury's eyes. Okay, a preliminary hearing. Preliminary hearing is very early in the trial by jury process. The prosecutor goes to court and they present the evidence to say, all right, there's been this offense that's committed. We have good reason to believe that this person may have committed the crime of which we're accusing him or her. And the accused can bring in attorneys and cross-examine witnesses. It's basically a hearing. Preliminary, of course, is before, so it's before the actual trial. And the charge is tested. They try to figure out whether or not it's worth going forward with a full trial, because as we talked about, trials are expensive, and you want to be sure that you can reduce the cost whenever possible. The arraignment actually comes before the preliminary hearing. It's basically a reading of the charges. You guys have seen it on Law and Order SVU and Law and Order Criminal Intent, whatever you watch there, where, you know, they come in and the district attorney says, you know, the people accuse this guy of this crime. How do you plead? The defendant says not guilty. Bail is set. That's an arraignment. Okay, so it's essentially a public notification of the charges and a public announcement of the pleading of the suspect. Okay, let's talk about a couple of early cases. In the Irwin versus Dowd case, Leslie Mad Dog Irwin, and we're going to see a lot of people do an awful lot of naughty things in this chapter. You get some very twisted people. This guy had confessed to 6 murders. The state had sufficient evidence to convict him for 1. And after he was convicted, he alleged that the jurors had been affected by the publicity around his trial. And in fact, when the jury was asked, 8 out of 12 of them said they thought that Mad Dog was guilty even before a single word of evidence was spoken. So the Supreme Court said, that's not a fair trial. He needs a new trial. He gets a new trial, but he's convicted on the retrial. So there was sufficient evidence there, but again, the importance is to make sure that the accused person gets a fair and speedy trial under the Sixth Amendment. Individual at the bottom is Wilbert Rideau. He had killed a person and confessed to the killing while sitting in his jail cell with TV cameras running. So his confession in whole was shown on television. He got a new trial. He got reconvicted. And now he's been released. He was released in 2005. And actually, interestingly, while he was in jail, he sort of rehabilitated and did a lot of jailhouse journalism. So he's sort of an interesting guy. That's a picture of him. I believe he was speaking at Stanford in 2005 or 2006 after he was released. So these early cases, again, you start to see the idea that the court is really concerned about preserving the Sixth Amendment rights of a defendant, but they often get convicted on retrial in any event. All right. Very important case. There are two really big cases in this. There are a lot of cases, but two really, really big ones, and this is one of them. Shepard versus Maxwell. That dapper-looking man there is Sam Shepard and his lovely wife, Marilyn. Very sensational case. If you've seen the movie The Fugitive, it's based on his story. Sam Shepard was dozing on the couch in his home in, I believe it was Cleveland, Ohio, and his wife was in the back room, and somehow he was kind of in a half-asleep, half-awake state, and somebody, he said, had barged in, a bushy-haired intruder had barged in and murdered his wife and stolen some of their things. And this was the, you know, the trial of the century in Ohio. The jurors' photos were on the front page, something that would never be permitted today. Their addresses were available to the media, so the media was going to their homes and talking to them about the case. Reporters were sitting practically with their arms around the defendant and the prosecution in front of the bar, basically inside the barb that separates the audience in a trial from the participants. Very high profile case. They had screaming headlines in some of the newspapers. Dr. Sam guilty, 6-inch, you know, headlines. Big deal. As you might guess, Shepard was convicted. He appealed. He said there is no way, given the high profileness of the trial, the way in which the media behaved about it, that I could have gotten a fair trial. And the Supreme Court agrees. They said the publicity, the carnival atmosphere surrounding the trial, resulted in Dr. Sam not getting a fair trial. It's denied. He was given a new trial, and he was acquitted, but he had already spent 12 years in jail, and fairly quickly after he had gotten out, he died. His son is still engaged in attempting to clear his father's name through DNA evidence, testing, and some other events. So most of us tend to believe that there really was a bushy-haired intruder, that Dr. Sam probably was not the killer, but, you know, the case is still kind of open. What's important about this is not what happened to Dr. Sam, although it is a very sad story. What's important about this is that the Supreme Court took a look at the whole process and said, okay, judges, we realize that you have a difficult task ahead of you. We realize that you have to balance the rights of the media and the rights of the defendant. We want to give you some tools to do that. And so they provided what I call a laundry list, okay? To control the media outside slapping them with a gag order. And we're going to talk about a case that had to do with a gag order in a little bit. But the Supreme Court started out by saying, try these things first. First of all, the Supreme Court said, control how many journalists come in. Control where they sit. Judges, this is your courtroom. You have the right to control the physical space inside it. If you only want 4 reporters in and you want to tell them to sit in a particular place, you can do that. You have that right. And you have the contempt power to back up your demands that this happen the way you want to. So be sure that you control your courtroom space. Engage in time, place, and manner restrictions. You should also admonish the jury and reporters. Now, admonishing, of course, is telling them what to do. It's basically shaking your finger at them. But it's essentially a warning. Tell the jury that they are only permitted to focus on the evidence, that they're not permitted to do outside research or talk to their spouses or friends about the evidence in the case. They need to rely on the evidence that is presented before them in the trial. And warn the reporters that they're not to bug the jury and the attorneys and the other people in the case. In other words, put some controls and make sure that everybody understands what the ground rules are. Third, insulate the witnesses. The Supreme Court reminded judges that courtrooms have back doors. Courthouses have back doors. You don't have to march people up the front steps past the entire battery of reporters as they're trying to get to the front door of the courthouse. You can work them around the back. You can bring them in through side doors where they're less likely to be, you know, bothered by intrusive media. Okay. You can also gag them. Now, of course, we're going to find out that gag orders are generally not okay. Now, but you can suggest that people who are involved in the case, like lawyers and witnesses, not talk to the media. So you can't, it's really tough to gag the media, as we're going to find out in the Nebraska Press Association case. But you can order people involved in the case, like witnesses and lawyers, not to talk, you know, to the media. So the media can still write about the case, but they're not necessarily going to have that special access. The Supreme Court gave a couple other options. A change of venue. In other words, you can move the trial from one location to another to be sure that the jury gets away from that publicity and to make sure that the publicity doesn't unduly taint the jury pool. You can also grant a continuance, make a delay, right? Give them 2 or 3 weeks or a month to cool off and see if that pretrial publicity has died down. You can also engage in better voir dire. If you've ever sat on a jury or been through a jury process, there's a discussion. You need to focus on the evidence. The judge can order them, and the attorneys can also ask questions like, do you read a lot of media? How do you think that the media coverage of this case has affected your ability to be able to be fair and impartial? And again, these people are sworn under oath. They should be telling the truth about whether or not they can be impartial. That's another tool in the laundry list. There's also sequestering the jury. Again, most of the time this doesn't happen because it's expensive for the state, but it is an option, in particularly in high-profile cases. There can be an ordering of the new trial. Judges don't like to do this because they're often overturned on appeal, but that is an option when, you know, all else fails. These rules are there to help the judges. These are a list of rules that the Supreme Court provided to judges to see whether or not they would be able to provide sufficient protection for defendants without impinging on the media's right to cover the trial.